I could see tomorrow I would breathe, I could sleep.
Welcome to the November 19th edition of Dramas Text. Tonight on the show, we're going to present the work of Californian poet Indigo Moore. He was the poet laureate of Sacramento. He's the author and playwright. Indigo Moore has been the recipient of numerous prizes. Tonight we're hearing a lecture that he presented at the University of California, and it's available via the University of California's television series. Well, here he is, Indigo Moore.
Thank you, Giovanni, for that wonderful introduction. And thank you, everyone, for coming. I'm going to be reading from both my collections today, first starting with Taproot. There came a time when I realized I'd been estranged from the South. I grew up in North Carolina for about 10 years, and I'd been estranged from my brother for about 18 years. This recounts the time when I received the phone call that he was dying of AIDS. Back through the storm door. I left the South broken, a busted wing and a crooked eye. Still, I wake mornings with the taste of honeysuckle on my tongue. The phone rings, voices weary with traveling, wires weighed down with crows in thick heat. I know it's the South, calling me to christen the born or bury the dead. Lord, I'm still addicted to its touch. He doesn't have long. If you're going to come, it better be soon. In bed, hours later, my mind still taloned to the phone's bad news. Weed, codeine, scotch. I've ingested enough fog and brain ash to black out the moon, but the crucible of the past is relentless, grinding behind eyelids. Memories spark wild along the nerve's telegraph. The lens focuses backwards and the mind grays decades. I dream my past, a fragmented play, spliced together with rawhide ties and silk thread. It grows claws and jumps to stage, a beast my hands don't know how to tame. There is no balm for the past dull ache. When the blue jay rolls up his song, the whole damn world spins down on me. Falling back through the door, I'm broken again. My brother and I grew up with my grandfather on a farm, and there did come a time when he was getting ready to sell it. And there was this old stump in the back that we used to play on. And it's amazing as a child thinking of the things that make a difference. It takes many years of studying for you to be able to gather the words to express your thoughts. Uprooted. It took all our weight to drag the chain over the stump. My brother and I, heaving links heavy enough to strangle hope. Our hands lost in grandfather's big work gloves. Slick grass betrayed our bare feet. The tractor vibrated low, hummed, screeched, and began humming again. Smoke marbled gray the blue morning. Where we had once played King of the Hill on the stump's weathered face, we now played Judas with an iron-linked kiss. Grandfather spat red fox tobacco, feathered the clutch once to tighten the noose. The engine leaned, a runner into wind, as the chain notched deep into the wood, lover's embrace gone shockingly wrong. The stump shuddered, groaned, wrenched from the earth, and tilted skyward. I don't know what we expected. There were no ghosts, no magic, only naked roots torn from the soil. We stood with our hands at our sides, lost in the tremor, song of earth, all of us broken like a promise. Days passed until once more we circled the stump, each of us secretly hoping that whatever love had married this stump to earth could have time to slip away. We then laid axe to wood and released the rings. I spent time in Reading, Pennsylvania with a stepfather, and he and his friends all worked in a steel refinery for 6 days, and they had one day off, and I always remembered sitting at the top of the stairs and listening to them getting ready to go out. Nomads. For 6 days, we purified metal, sleepwalking through sulfur clouds. A few pennies forged for every muscled clang of pig iron and rust. Friday's whistle, our Pavlovian call to bedlam, triggers us down to dogs. Come Saturday, we hang our checks on new shoes, silk ties, gold chains, scrub iron ore from our fingers, coke dust from our faces before slow fading from day to night. A bottle of gin passes between us. We stiff leg and hip drop a pimp down the boulevard. Tug our hats down until our faces are curved horizons with brown felt suns rising askew. Walking the bricks, we crave music worth killing for. Manna soaked in bourbon, grilled over hot Mississippi coals. The Easy Lion Jazz Joint excels an intoxicating vibration of wood stomp and tremor slide. Bass so cold it shatters hot breath. The sax man's vibrato wrenches moans from our bodies, sways us into fevered cattails wrapped in silk and sweat. Spit-shined leather begins to fly. Two more juke joints before sunrise, a plate of ribs and a whiskey sour. Sunday morning is a hangover, hard as an I-beam stove into our heads. All too soon, the factory whistle. In Taproot, there's an entire section dedicated to music, so I'm going to do a couple more poems on music. The next one is the title poem for the manuscript, Taproot. And it came up at a time that I was doing a study of the blues, and I was reading up on Muddy Waters. And I found out an interesting fact that he grew up on the spot in the shack on the Mississippi Plains where the Mississippi River used to be before they dammed it up. Taproot. Concrete and steel drew the Mississippi back like a fist. Scythe blades swung through dry harvests. Plows turned soil hard enough to raise the blues. Muddy water sprang whole, dry heaved from the knotted center of a plankwood shack. He shook himself loose of blood, dirt, moonshine, the ash darkened of a mule, and was gone. Since, twisters have spun the shack round, bent its insides out, till it vomited its secrets on boot dust roads. Now tourists use splintered slivers of history as toothpicks. A little ways down the road, you can squander a week's pay, sleep in an old slave shack, spend a day picking cotton, smile for pictures. The Mississippi used to cover these parts until they dammed it up, held its tongue like words you choke back in church to keep your insides from escaping. Staring across dusty fields, you can ache the need for river, almost drown in the longing for waters that won't come here no more. one more musician from my past. Robert Johnson, as Giovanni was alluding to in her wonderful introduction, is a blues legend, a great musician, and he's considered the father of modern-day blues. One of his songs, of course, sings of the crossroads, where he supposedly sold his soul to learn how to play. My son, who's a musician and a guitarist, would point out the fact that he sort of disappeared from the scene for 7 years. It may have had something to do with how he developed the style that he was playing in. But one of the lesser-known facts about him is that he was cheap, extremely cheap. And and one of the ways that he decided that he was going to get the money to travel to Chitlin Circuit was to make sure that he didn't have to pay for hotels. And he did this by seducing women, usually married women and homely women. This is his words, not mine, and the historians, because in his mind, a homely woman whose husband would not kill him if they ever found out. Interestingly enough, the one time that he deviated from this and did seduce a beautiful woman, he was poisoned on stage that night, so. But I always wondered what it must have been like for him to wake up in another man's bed, so. Another man's bed. My dream is always I wake to a ruptured silence. An ice pick cracking my dream slumber. Impulse says, get your shoes. Keyhole will suck daylight from the room. Get your shoes, boy. My left hand sweeps the floor beside the bed. Is this how death catches me? One hand lost in dust. Where the hell are my shoes? There's a dim streetlight glow pushing through the window, gray in the room. My eyes become focused rods, divining shape from shadow. Someone has polished my wingtip shoes, granted them flight, nested them on the dresser. The chair in the corner now wears a hat, grinds on the cigar. Its single smoldering eye finds mine, smoke climbing the air like ivy on an invisible trellis. A gentle click and a tiny hole floats above the chair's arm, deep, hungry, trying to drag the room into its mouth. Six chambered screams curled like fetuses in lead wombs. A silk sigh, rustling of sheets as she shifts beside me. I lie unbreathing, an eternity away from motion, wondering which way is gonna roll me into a grave. Okay, I lied. One more music poem. Last Call Improv. It's set to the backdrop of a Cecil Taylor. Cecil Taylor's a wonderful jazz musician, jazz pianist, and this is set to the backdrop of a Cecil Taylor concert. Last Call Improv. My apology melts into vodka and swirling ice. Her fingers lost trace the links on her necklace. On stage, Cecil Taylor cuts heads with his quartet. Autumnal waves plug the silences in our last dinner together. Two cliff divers on a dizzying drop from grace. A rapid descent key change closes her eyes. Cecil's fingers dig into a flat B, drag us into the rhythm. My breath grazes her ear. Baby, do you remember when Cecil played that set that smokes in the city? She leans away into stage light glare. That wasn't him. Cecil's fingers duel with ivory. Keys obey. Heart pulp and blood fruit stain the Steinway's checkered grin. Her hand slips away as Adagio moves to Allegro. Bass player growls his wide-legged stance. On the table, my returned key is a whale beached beyond the sweat of her glass. The rhythm leans us into calypso. Cecil stomps fire wood to wood, kicks out the back wall, blacks out the sun. 20 years ago, she wore black silk. I kissed her in a field before a rise of quail against burnt red clouds. Cecil curled smooth as incense from our radio as we teased a xylophone of each other's spine. The drummer hits a tripwire, drags me away from shrapnel memories. We snap our fingers to the deep sweetness trapped in our skin, but there are still no words we share. A tear rolls down her cheek. She wipes it away before I can. Two more poems from Taproot, then I'll move on to Through the Stonecutter's Window. Pull. I am told it was moonlight that ripened your failing heart until it finally cracked, sent the clock hand spinning off your flesh. I was a coward. Still 3,000 miles away, convincing myself that if I came at all, I could never catch the dying hour. Forgive me, brother. For decades, your name has stretched my tongue to breaking, but love and pain often anguish logic. Long ago, on a night like this, I watched Uncle rocket a coyote skyward with a fistful of buckshot. It slammed to the ground, twisted, skidding across the grass. Somehow, it didn't know that it was dead. Front legs pawed the air as if leveled by nothing more than errant moonlight. Chicken feathers lined its muzzle. It mewled, eyes tunneling through me to the underbrush where its mate stood, now crosshair down Uncle's barrel and already dead by every book and clock. The mate stood mesmerized, not knowing that in this world, every fool carries a twin heart. Bang! I shouted. And the underbrush went wild with the mate's running. Still, if animals have souls, two die that night. Uncle cursed me under the killing sky. Why, boy? You know she'll hit the coop later. Don't you know that? This is my understanding of the fear and silences of these wounded nights. The moon snares in the sweet spot of the throat, and everything and everyone that lives on is trapped in love. I've been talking to just about everyone who will listen about the trials and tribulations I'm having trying to get my stage play on stage. And if any of the actors who have flaked today would be watching this later, yes, I've been talking about y'all. There is a theater term in the called apotheosis, which basically means it's similar to Deus Ex Machina, but in this case, at the end of the play, when the playwright has, in my opinion, no idea how to end the play, the heavens open up, there's clarion horns, lights, and everyone ascends to heaven. I will assure you that nothing like that has ever happened in my life, but this is as close to an approximation as I'll ever get. Apotheosis. There is an extra star in Orion's belt. I arc my mason jar up through the fading light and snatch the firefly in mid-pulse. The heat lightning is a distant sweetness. Sugar pink throbs on nimbus clouds draining from the night's basin. A screech owl's cry hugs the pine-peaked horizon. Behind me is an aluminum whoosh, a swing, a miss, a curse. In Firefly Baseball, the elusive lime green flickerings mock us all. Blind in the graying, we are forever doomed to swing where they were. We swear in corkscrew to the ground. The tall, uncut grass plays slivered kite to the evening breeze. Silhouetted, Mama laughs at every exaggerated lunge, twist, and fall. Her fingers are Promethean tongs that trap each cigarette's volcanic ember. But tonight, there is more flame than heart and hand can hold. A 12 firefly lantern pressed to my cheek. Does my face glow, Mama? Do I shine? Tomorrow noon, the rusted beak of the weather vane will swing north. Mama, summer, the fireflies all gone. Through the stonecutter's window, taproot was a major undertaking. I have a term that I use entitled Gateway Poems and Books, and I felt that was mine. It's those poems or that book that you have to write before you can write anything else. So by the time I got to Through the Stonecutter's Window, I had so much that I was ready to write about and so many different ways that I wanted to do it that I realized after I'd been submitting the manuscript that I woke up one morning, I was like, oh my God, is anybody going to even understand what I was doing? And I was very fortunate that Northwestern University Press and Cave Canem did. I am an opinionated person, and sometimes too much, but I had a way that I wanted to do things, and many times I was purposely writing things that I knew would not survive workshop because I'm not always the biggest fan of how I can bring things down. But one of the things I do love to do is ekphrastic work, and that's work that's written about particular pieces of art. I was invited to do this poem about a Monet piece, and actually I was invited down, told it was a Monet piece, but when I got down there, it was actually a picture of Monet himself, which was very much different, and then not even in his younger years, where he's very vibrant and large, it was when he was older and somewhat decrepit and in a rocking chair, but I took the challenge. Veiled vision. Anchored, as his tired bones insisted, to the chair, sunken into a cashmere coat with thick raised collar. You had no choice but to swirl his weight onto the wicker armrest. You give us Monet, subtracted by everything he no longer is. Cataracts stacking behind shades, shrunken skull plastered beneath the brim of a gaudy sun hat. No wonder he succumbed to this pose. Camille, Alice, and Jean are dead, fading as his days and his eyesight. Gently he rocks, the cottage before him, the bridge after, off the focus of the canvas. I can almost see you, pyrrhically calling brilliant stroke and heroic light to take arms against the dying of Claude's seasons, yet not even your signature, resembling a Roman numeral 9, can resurrect feline litheness into his body. Of the futility he must sense in you, the bemused tilt of his head says all we need to know. Beneath the light-soaked beard, our lips pressed to keep the secret you are desperate to protect us from. A day will come for each of us when we are nothing more than still life in another's eyes. When I was moving to California from North Carolina, one of the things I was looking forward to seeing was hummingbirds, because I had this idyllic vision of them, as most people do, as you can tell by the paintings and the many ceramics and everything else out there about them. And I was so excited to get a hummingbird feeder in my backyard, and so I did. But all this wonderful sharing that they do is great when the food is there, but when the food is scarce, they turn into some vicious little hummingbirds' clothing. I am all wing and hollow bone, strung together with frayed nerves. No, I am not darting aimlessly. My job, thankless, is to connect your backyard's invisible braille while tilting, drunk on scarlet nectar. Lean close to hear my buzzing revelation. I am an anger god, praying for a brawl, a brother to fly too close and reveal me king of the low-hung sky. Each wing beat jackhammers the day into submission as the sweet breath detonates on my tongue. There's a restaurant in Sacramento, where I'm from, that I love to go to, and I kept telling my friend who's from Syria about this wonderful Turkish restaurant downtown that I kept inviting her to come see and inviting her to come see, and she finally came from Texas, where she lives, and she took one look around as she walked into the place and said, "This place isn't Turkish, it's Moroccan." By that time, the poem had already been written and published. It's Turkish. Glass. I vowed never again to cross that street, but the snake charmer laid his flute along my spine. Sodium light painted my shadow crooked across the restaurant's plate glass, my breath quickening against the pain. Inside, mint teas, incense, dark spices tinted the air. A belly dancer timed finger cymbals and a coin sash to a baglama's dulcet strumming. Hand-woven tapestries thickened the walls, tugging at connecting studs. Couches crouched low and sensuous. Every divan and ottoman adorned with scented pillows and entwined legs. She and I were only here once, I reminded myself. Still, the music pulsed the glass beneath my fingers as hookah pipes rose and fell like empires, like longing. My son, who accompanied me to Chicago for the release of this book, and of course, you know, being my son, he had never really listened to my poetry much before. He realized that many of the poems that I was reading either had something to do with something I was mistaken about, or something I had no clue what was going on. This is probably a little of both. I had a text plan for a while that on my phone that I was getting charged for every text that I got. And I started receiving this text that I had no clue who the person was. But I didn't want to write them and tell them because I was afraid they'd stop. Because whoever it was leading the most interesting life you could imagine. And they were letting me live vicariously through it. And it took 3 months before I finally got up the nerve to ask who they were. Messages from the ether. Your first text put you in the Decameron, tracking Bokasha through love sickness, deep moist erotica. You leave no name, your number unrecognizable. Weeks later, I'm in City Lights, coaxing Jane Shore to raise the trapeze artist once more from concrete and straw. I read that you are hours away from winging above my head through fog and spring, on your way to Hong Kong. That night, I dreamed dragon smoke, scripting my name against a flame red sky. A month later, man on wire traps you between two towers, glued to a wire swaying over a man-made chasm. I'm in bed, nursing a knee swollen around an ACL stretched to disbelief. You say Petite left you dizzy, mind spiraling, unhinged above the rubble that will be decades later, dragging glass and ruin beneath autumn's indifference. 3 months pass before I ask who you are. Careful of the fragility of names and faces made concrete, easily shattered. It's Eva, you reply, from Boston, from the Fog Museum, from theater and poetry. Eva, my friend, as I write this poem, Boston should be past the flowering season, heat hovering over the Charles, dragonflies rustling. I imagine you sitting lotus style on the north bank, hair tied, a knot that trails down your back. You lean over your phone, concentrating on every letter and symbol before winging them across ether.
Hi, you're listening to CKUT 90.3 on the FM dial. We've just heard the work of Indigo Moore, poet laureate of Sacramento, and his work is found on the University of California television series. Coming up, we'll be listening to Camille T. Dongui, also poet, editor, winner of numerous prizes. Several of her books include Trophic Cascade in 2017, Smith Blue in 2011, Suck on the Marrow 2010, which winner of the American Book Award, California Book Award Silver Medal, and the Northern California Book Award. She currently teaches English at the University of California. Here's the work of Camille T. Dongui, also found on the University of California television series, Lunchtime Poetry television series.
This program is a presentation of UCTV for educational and non-commercial use only.
Before her heart, a mechanical aperture closed. Her heart, a mechanical aperture opened. She told her stomach, "Honey, be still." She told her teeth and her cheeks and her tongue, all the squabbling was quail close at hand. Her heart, a perennial shrub, persisted. She'd been waiting. She'd looked forward to this. She told her wrist and her waist and her ankles, all that rustling was quail in the rushes. To the skin on her left arm, keep watch. To her lungs, prepare all your rooms. Her heart, deciduous, bloomed. She'd breakfasted on rye toast spread with the hope sauce of bees and of thistle. She'd been waiting. In her rucksack, she tended the first crush of olives and nearly transparent, delicious meats so rare, should she share her heart, that tide pool would flood. She'd been waiting. She told the pit of her navel and the peaks of her nipples that cooing was quail coming near. The call was the response she'd expected all the days she'd looked forward to this. Though her heart, brookbed, was dammed, she kept two small thieves in their sockets alert. She commandeered all the rafts in her spine. She told her heart, take everything. When he handed his hand to her hand, and the bevy, beautiful in the bushes, flew. Language. Silence is one part of speech. The war cry of wind down a mountain pass, another. A stranger's voice echoing through lonely valleys. A lover's voice rising so close, it's your own tongue. These are keys to cipher. The way the high hawk's key unlocks the throat of the sky and the coyote's yip knocks it shut. The way the aspen's bells conform to the breeze while the rapids' drums define resistance. Sage speaks with one voice, pinion with another. Rock, wind her hand, water her brush, spells, and then scatters her demands. Some notes tear and pebble our paths. Some notes gather the bank we map our lives around. Long time gone, long time yet to come. Where jasmine lemon sweets wind and salt slicks the breeze, where sage spices sun-drench, there. Where the fragrant cloud nest drives the pump beat of my blood, I am home. Long time gone, and don't know when I'm coming back. But see me there, where the orange tree blossoms and the sky smells white as line-dried sheets. See me there, where jasmine lemon sweets wind and salt slicks the hair you wear into the breeze, where cactus fruit is suckling pear and its sweet hidden waters everywhere. I am home. Am gone, but I'll be back. Long time gone, but I'll be coming back. The preachers eat out. There were maybe four of them, perhaps five. They were headed where? It does not matter. Only they were not home yet. We're not near anyone who could have cared. So hungry, they stopped there anyway. And when they heard, "We don't serve your kind," one among them laughed. "That's okay. We're not hungry for our kind. We've come for food." And when the one waitress who would serve them, she had children at home, and these were tips, finished breaking their plates behind the building, he called her over to the table. "Lady, my one regret is that we don't have appetite enough to make you break every damned plate inside this room. You are not the one Melinda sings her underbreath song to please. You, Joseph Freeman, who once would sing words the sermon could not say, the whole church waiting Sundays for the Freeman song, and especially waiting for the bass cry, such remembrance in your young body that was Joseph Freeman singing in meeting. You, Joseph, are not the one who will sit in the men's pew singing, as you sang Sundays, surrounded by your brother, your father, your uncle, Melinda, your oldest friends, the whole church, maybe even the good Lord listening. No, Joseph, you are not the one whose back heat and resting weight that pew's wood will curve and cup itself to welcome. You are no more the one that pew's arch would recognize today than you are the man who will hear tonight what new song Melinda in the rocking chair. No more your rocking chair than her rooms are anymore your rooms. Will catch under her breath and sing. When you were Joseph, when you had two rooms, you could give your wife your hands and ears and mouth inside. You listened. You let your wife keep you awake, trilling over what she'd cleaned that afternoon. A cameo. Her lips a closed purse when she pronounced the M opened for you on the E, wider on the O, strung on velvet. You wrapped a band around her neck, kisses ending where the cameo would fall at the hollow, that perfect frame. When you had two rooms and no one but your wife inside them, you could listen all night to the things she desired. Silk stockings, for instance. What, you asked, was wrong with the stockings she wore? These wool ones? You touched the leg she lifted toward you. I would be just as happy not to wear them a minute more. And didn't you listen to her? Didn't you lend your hand and help Melinda peel those old stockings away? Now you are a mouth tasting dust and salt and finger flesh. You are all your remaining teeth arranged to satisfaction, gums just pink enough to please. You are a saleable mouth, and your tongue does nothing. It does not curl into a consonant. It does not shape the vowels that would add up to a plea, because you are not Joseph Freeman, night guard of Melinda. The ones who wait on your voice are not the ones whose listening would make a morning right. Before, you were nothing but an auctioned mouth and a pair of hands that only mind commands. They made you little more than a brine-sealed back and crossed-hatched thighs. Your tongue twisted in quick tempos as you learned each new instrument's name. Cat-o'-nine-tails, pudding stick, ordinary ore. You'd rather keep silent than call up more cognates. You, Joseph Freeman, who once would sing words. Taming Shad. Two things he didn't understand. Even after she let him pull her up into the wide hug of the sycamore branches, and after she took to tying her hair in red ribbons he used Sunday wages to buy for her. What had Molly's little nod meant that first day her body, a blue bag gripped in one hand, ran across his shadow? Laundry day. So she was busy. But something made her take time to answer a question he hadn't realized he'd already asked. That was one thing he couldn't understand. What made her nod yes to a dusty bruise of a man just walked up to the Jackson place after how long trotting behind his newest master and his master's paint? The other thing was why, after all those nights studying the creases in his thumbs, the lobes of his ears, the direction sweat took running off his belly, she stayed away from him until the morning glories that had opened in his eyes closed again. Should she have to remind him, wasn't nothing to be seen that he could look after? And something like a response. Almost like they wanted it. Because she'd heard him laugh through new moon darkness, and she knew he'd fallen, and she knew before she turned he'd be crawling like a crawdad rock to loam. Because she tried to love the straight back and neck he'd erected to recollect the man he'd been before. Because she found herself adding up his usefulness like some kind of auctioneer. She showed him the dark coils areoling both her breasts and all the ways she bent and lifted, steady, strong. She let him believe he was past due for a harvest, and her hands were the right ones now to hold the scythe. She made quick work of pleasure. The boy's smile bunked down in his eyes, she claimed. Her tongue found the place in his mouth where the teeth were gone, where he'd hold his corn cakes until they grew soft enough to chew. History had bedded him in all of this. his own history, and failures not his own. Before he'd tramped in, she'd watched another man, a man she thought she hated, watched his body opened, 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 until blood had married brine. She'd watched that man be whipped into something good for nothing more than fertilizing clay, and she'd thought buckshot would have been a brand of kindness if sprayed into him just then. But even after his hard going, she did not miss him very much. Anyone she chose could be shucked like surplus property tomorrow, but that hadn't been enough to warn her off of picking him that night. Because she knew if she set her sight on nothing, she'd get nothing in return. She'd walked with Shad. But because the night progressed so, because there were some clouds, no stars, no moon, he'd tripped over the branch of a dead and down tree. In all that darkness, there, without a moon, even then she had not fallen. She thought to say so, but she did not say so. She did nothing but say she was sorry for him. She did not use her mouth to say this. Could he not listen to her hands? They spoke softly, articulating her condolences to his torn and bleeding skin. Sunday morning. Desire swung like that, like her legs in procession, like perfume from a censer on its linked chain, heavy as smoke in the hold's light, desire. A church, a cathedral, the body in that robe, the robe sash swinging, the progress through the sinning body to this sacred spot. A man kneeling, a man with head bent, a man lifting his prayer to a woman. Desire, desire, desire. Grant us grace. The blue. One will live to see the caterpillar rut everything they walk on. Sea cliff buckwheat cleared, relentless ice plant to replace it. The wild fields bisected by the scenic highway. Canyons covered with cul-de-sacs, gas stations, comfortable homes. The whole habitat along this coastal stretch endangered. Everything, everyone, everywhere in it in danger as well. But now, they're logging the one stilling hawk Smith sights. The conspiring grasses, shh, shh, shh. The Coreopsis Matoni's boot barely spares. And netted, a solitary blue butterfly. Smith, ahead of him chasing the stream, Matoni wonders if he plans to swim again. Just like that, the spell breaks. It's years later, Matoni lecturing on his struggling butterfly. How fragile. If his daughter spooled out the fabric she'd chosen for her wedding gown, raw taffeta burled, a bright-hued tan, perhaps Matoni would remember how those dunes looked from a distance. The fabric balanced between her arms, making valleys in the valley. The fan above her mimicking the breeze. He and his friend loved everything softly undulating under the coyous wind, and the rough truth as they walked through the land scratch and scrabble, and no one was there then besides Matoni and his friend walking along Dolan's Creek in that part of California they hated to share. The ocean a mile or so off, anything but passive, so that even there, in the canyon, they sometimes heard it smack and pull well-braced rocks. The breeze basic, salty, bitter, sour, sweet. Smith trying to identify the scent, tearing leaves of manzanita, yelling, "This is it! Here! This is it!" His hand to his nose, his eyes having finally seen the source of his pleasure, alive. In the lab, after the accident, he remembered it, the butterfly. How good a swimmer Smith had been, how rough the currents there at Half Moon Bay. His friend alone with reel and rod, Matoni back at school early that year, his summer finished too soon. Then all of them together in the sneaker wave. And before that, the ridge, congregations of pinking blossoms, and one of them bowing, scaring up the living, the frail and flighty beast too beautiful to never be pinned. Those nights Matoni worked without his friend, he remembered too. He called his butterfly Smith's Blue. Out of the darkness. In the beginning was the darkness, and the darkness drew together, and the darkness warmed the darkness, and it was not alone. But some of the darkness began to pull away. The great crowd of darkness was disturbed. This is how darkness turned against darkness. Some of the darkness lost hair in the fight. This hair fell to the historians, spiders. Each relays the filaments just as she discovers them. Some of the darkness lost legs in the fight. These ran on and still dashed through dreams. Where the blood of the darkness met the sweat of more darkness, in that place, a tree. In the tree, some quaking possum. Below it, a hound. Where the tears of the darkness fell, high grass grew, through which run rivulets of an antlered herd. Whenever darkness struck darkness, one fewer in the herd, a new cat sprung from the grasses. The darkness went down, and the darkness rose up. More darkness fell while some rose still. The movement of the darkness as it fought against darkness was like the movement of oceans. Soon, some of the darkness was ocean. The remaining darkness was sky. What darkness had fallen might rise. What darkness had risen might lose wind and fall. This could go on forever. The rising of darkness, its falling. Some of the darkness lost teeth in the fight. These became teeth of the ancient, vigilant shark. Some of the darkness lost nails in the fight. These became thorns in the bramble. Some of the darkness lost sight in the fight. Some of the darkness lost reason. Some of the darkness got away from the darkness. That darkness alone drew a star. That's a state I'll never go back to. Once I got over the problem of not knowing how, I couldn't go back to not curbing my tires. But it took a while to get past forgetting to register street cleaning hours. And love. Love was my handicap. Though I had no permit to hang from my rear view. So I collected 7 or 10 little slips. I had every intention of paying off, except I skipped town for the summer. And returned to find the guy staying in my apartment tossed them. I'll admit, I was relieved not to face these expensive reminders of the girl I'd been. How stupid I was about life in the city. And as I'd finished school, was moving south for good this time. And as I lived then in a state of great anticipation, the potential of a record never crossed my mind. But now, on account of those parking tickets, I can't go back there with a car. Though everyone who loves me knows I love that tiny window each October in the south nub of the state you can't reach without driving. I missed it once and waited a whole year regretting the lost chance to track the linden leaves' tiny migrations. The next fall, refusing to endure that state of desolation again, I asked everyone who loves me to please meet me just south of the border. We ordered green mussels. We ordered popcorn shrimp. The shrimp beat the mussels to the table. I was the only one who hadn't filled up on a grande egg cream. I drink for pleasure, but since I left that state, I haven't found any delicious enough to entice. So I ate all the mussels. Crouched later in that state of betrayal that comes from learning some green things aren't good. Considering the law of inertia that any body in motion stays in motion unless faced with an equal or opposite force, peer pressure, scatology, the projected near immediate devastation of world forests should certain highly populated nations generally adopt the U.S. model of toilet paper consumption. Germ theory, my own role in depressing the mean average of common human hygiene. I knew I never wanted to be anywhere near that state again. With extradition, with reciprocity, I was hardly away at all. When I first rolled over, my parents were pleased. And just as quickly, I left the state of never having rolled before. Ditto, slumping on all fours to crawling. And once I could walk, we all knew I was never going back. I pulled myself up and started moving. I grabbed at everything I could reach. Until I learned better, I'd put my tongue on anything. Once, I ate papaya straight from the tree, and then I mourned the abject state of the crated fruit I, in my ignorance, thought I loved. I denounced such love. I married a local. I taught myself how to keep his garden. I swear I'm staying away from that state for good.
That concludes this week's edition of Drama Text. We've heard the work of Indigo Moore and Camille Dungy, available both from the University of California television series, the Lunchtime Poetry Series. We'll be back next week with another hour-long presentation of The Spoken Word. Till then.